This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. West of Jesus, Surfing, Science, and the Origins of Belief is an ambitious exploration of various states of consciousness and the function of myth in different cultures. Author Stephen Kotler has found in surfing a route into anthropology, psychology, religion, mysticism, and maybe even self-awareness. The book begins with his contention that he went to Mexico to surf because the stories he had told himself had begun to fail. I spoke with Stephen Kotler in July of 2006, and I asked him what had happened to deprive his repertoire of stories of their power and meaning.
Well, my earliest childhood belief was this sneaking suspicion that the world was a much more mysterious place than people were letting on. And by the time I got to college, that had turned into a full-blown Jonathan Livingston Siegelitis. Mm. So at the end of my sophomore year, I dropped out and I moved to Santa Fe because the New Age was booming. And over the course of the next couple of years, it was ashrams and monasteries and strange chants and strange mushrooms and shaman. And when it was all said and done, I could sit in the full lotus for about 5-6 hours at a time, and I never once achieved a mystical anything. Mm. So I decided it was all hokey, it was all nonsense, and I became a science geek, a really hardcore rational materialist. I dove into science writing and science journalism, and to me, medicine was the apogee of all of this. And in 2000, I got Lyme disease, and a couple years later, the miracle of modern medicine had completely failed me. I was still deathly ill. The doctors had kind of thrown up their hands. There's not a whole lot you can do with chronic Lyme. And, you know, my last remaining belief, which was in all this science stuff, kind of was ripped from me. So there was really nothing left at that particular point.
One of the things that you found when you had run out of stories was a mysterious tale about a figure called the Conductor. And since that tale in some ways provides the spine of West of Jesus, maybe you'd better tell it.
Well, the really short version is the Conductor is a surfer who controls the waves and the weather. He conducts the waves with a baton made of human bone.
And you heard that story twice.
I did. I heard it in very different places. I heard it the first time back in 1996. I was in Indonesia. I was a novice surfer. I had kind of met a group of Australians who actually kept me out of jail, but that's a long story and it's in the book. But they kept me out of jail, and I got them really drunk to say thank you, and they convinced me to go surf this place called Nusa Dua. I knew nothing about it. And it was a big day when we got out there, and I definitely shouldn't have been out there. And a very big wave landed on me, and seven more landed on me, and the reef is really close under the water, and I was bloody. I was puking water when it was all said and done, and I kind of was anchored outside the reef trying to recover. And an Australian guy who I met down there had paddled over to me, and he was like, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Well, you know, except for the bleeding and the puking, I'm just fine, thanks." He said, "Yeah, it looks like the Conductor had his way with you." And 9 years later, in 2003, I was in Mexico surfing hurricane swell. Again, I was over my head. I shouldn't have been doing it. And again, I got mauled and mashed by a bunch of waves and a bunch of rocks, and I was recovering on the boat. And this surfer I met down there named Ben, who was from New York, paddled over to me and said, "Hey, man, looks like the Conductor had his way with you." And that's when it caught my attention.
Why did you choose sports, and specifically surfing, as a way of understanding various aspects of neuroscience and exploring myths and mysticism? Because there were all number of routes that might have been open to you in that.
Well, what happened to me is I had been in bed for a good couple years, and I was about as despondent as you could possibly get, and I was really considering suicide very, very, very seriously. And a friend of mine called and said, "Let's go surfing." And I just started laughing because it was this ridiculous request. I could barely walk across the room, let alone go surfing. But she was really insistent, and I figured, you know what? I can always kill myself tomorrow. I'll go surfing today. It was unlike any of my Northern California early surf experiences. The waves were soft. The water was warm. And I got out there. I had this huge board, and I sat down on it. And 30 seconds later, a wave came. And it certainly was all muscle memory. I could barely stand up. It was ridiculous. But I caught that wave, and for the first time in a couple of years, I really wanted to be alive. It was an astounding, astounding feeling. And I caught four more waves. That's how excited I was. After those waves, I was completely disassembled. They had to drive me back to my apartment and put me to bed, and I was in bed for a couple of weeks. And on the 15th day, I got out and I went surfing again. And over a period of time, I started to feel better. But more mysterious than that, over this period of time, I started to believe in surfing like it was a new religion. And that didn't make any sense to me. All of it was weird. I didn't know why I was surfing myself back to health. Surfing's not found in the normal cures of Lyme disease. And I didn't know why I was believing in this sport of surfing. I mean, it felt like aquatic hippie nonsense to me. But when I heard the conductor's tale that second time, here was this story with all this myth and this magic, and it was a surfing story. And I didn't know what this myth and magic was doing in the surfing story, just like I didn't know what was going on with me. And I thought, huh, maybe if I track this legend back to its point of origin, it'll give me a little bit of a window into what's going on with me.
A considerable portion of West of Jesus is about people who suddenly find themselves doing things they know they cannot do, such as you returning to surfing, I suppose. But perhaps you would read from page 183 to give our listeners a sense of how that happened to you one day when you were out in a surf that you really knew you couldn't handle.
I watched the wall set up, the water sock off the bottom, the curl begin to pitch. There was nowhere to go, and I was certain to fall. But I didn't fall. Somehow I sucked my knees towards my chest and floated across the closeout, dropping off the far end and into the next section of the wave. I made that section and then strung together a complicated series of maneuvers, despite the fact that I had never done any of them before, nor had I any idea how to do them. All of this was just happening. It was clearly impossible. Mine might be a world where I knew who was on the other end of the phone before I answered it, or what song was playing on the radio before the radio had been turned on. These, at least, were the kinds of anomalous events familiar to many. But a world where time slowed, where sound vanished, where vision worked in 360 degrees and I could really surf, this was an entirely new species of juju.
Now, given the perspective of time and dry land, can you explain that experience?
Well, I actually can, and the piece to that puzzle was solved by Malcolm Gladwell in his book Blink, where he interviewed a psychologist who had done a lot of work with cops in extreme high-pressure situations during gunfights and things like that. Mm. And one of the things that cops repeatedly report is that they often don't hear the sound of the guns firing, even though they're firing right beside their heads or they're firing the weapons themselves, and they can see their bullets entering the subject. And what you have to remember here is we don't actually interact with the real world. Our senses take in data, and then the brain shows us that data. So everything we see is first mitigated by the brain. And a couple of things happen in adrenaline situations like that. One of them is that the blood moves away from all the organs that are not crucial in that moment to the fight or flight thing. So one of the things that happens is blood moves away from the ears, thus the experience of sound funneling away and everything getting very, very quiet. The other thing that happens is the brain, because you're in a crisis situation, just slows things down for you. You see things at a much more slow playback rate. It's imagine, you know, a VCR or a tape like that. It's just on super slow play.
Mm. You surmise that, and I'm quoting this phrase, pinpoint concentration is one element necessary to triggering this particular state. Does pinpoint concentration come into surfing regularly, or is it only when you find yourself in a situation where, refer to your situation, holy cow, if I don't surf out of this situation, I'm going to get crushed and smashed into the reef and never come up?
Well, I'll answer that question, and I'll take it one step farther. One of the things about riding a wave that we know is it requires the exact same pinpoint focus that meditation does. But one of the things that this pinpoint focus tends to do is it produces an experience that surfers refer to as feeling one with the ocean, which, again, that's more aquatic hippie nonsense for you. But what we now know about this feeling of oneness is kind of peculiar. There's a neuroscientist named Andrew Newberg. He's the head of nuclear medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dr. Newberg got very, very curious about what was going on in the brains of Tibetan monks and Franciscan nuns during moments of peak meditation or peak experience. So what Dr. Newberg did is he used a SPECT scanner, which is a really, really good piece of brain imaging technology. He took pictures of the brains of Franciscan nuns and Tibetan Buddhists during moments of, you know, peak meditation. And what he found a lot of stuff that I won't talk about. One of the things he did find that a spot above the right ear called the right parietal lobe goes really, really quiet. The right parietal lobe is the part of the brain that helps the self orientate itself in space. Well, one of the things that the brain does every millisecond is ask these basic safety and security questions. Where am I? What's going on? What's new? What's different? The where am I question gets asked to the right parietal lobe because that's its job. And after a certain point when the right parietal lobe isn't going to respond, a feedback loop is going to develop and the brain is kind of going to panic and demand an answer. But because the right parietal lobe is shut down at this moment in time, it can't tell the difference between self and other. So when it answers that question, it's going to have no choice but to tell the brain that at this particular moment in time, you are one with everything. So this, you know, what, you know, 10 years ago, scientists would have told you was nonsense at best and psychosis at worst. And what 5 years ago, you know, surfers would have called aquatic hippie nonsense, turns out is neither. Turns out it's just standard biology.
You begin and end the book with that reference we spoke of a few minutes ago to Joan Didion's contention that we tell ourselves stories in order to live. Is it too melodramatic to suggest that in the process of turning up the material that became West of Jesus, you found the stories that would enable you to continue to live?
I think that is exactly what happened. Something about all of life is in a certain level about creating mythologies about ourselves and trying to become those mythologies or not becoming those mythologies. The little kid in his driveway shooting hoops, dreaming of being Michael Jordan, what's he doing? He's creating a mythology for himself, and he's going to drive towards that mythology, you know, until he either, you know, fails and gives up on it or succeeds. That's essentially, you know, what we do in this life. I ran out of stories, and then I created a whole new batch.
Stephen Kotler is the author of West of Jesus, subtitled Surfing Science and the Origins of Belief, published by Bloomsbury. He spoke to me from the studios of NPR West in Los Angeles. Stephen, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, bid calling as competition. But first, some of the best waves in the world attract surfers from around the globe to Indonesia's Mentawai Islands. But life for indigenous people there has not been idyllic. Islanders have suffered from malaria and malnutrition for decades. A quarter of their children die from preventable or treatable diseases. Now an organization partly funded by surfers is helping the Mentawai people. Only a Game's Trish Anderton visited the islands last summer and filed this story.
Lance's Right is a world-famous wave. You may well have seen it, even if you've never heard of it. It's splashed across advertisements and surfing videos everywhere, the kind of glossy tube surfers live for. On a speedboat just off the coast of the Mentawais, Dave Jenkins stops to take a long, hungry look.
It's just a perfect shape. It picks up a lot of swell, and it barrels every wave. So after you take off, it just creates this big barrel, and that's what most surfers dream of, getting a lot of barrels tucked inside, the ultimate adrenaline rush.
Jenkins is from New Zealand. He's a doctor, a surfer, and the founder of a humanitarian organization called Surf Aid. In 1999, Jenkins took a vacation on one of the luxury surf boats that anchor off the islands. One day, he and a friend went ashore at the nearest town, Katiet, population 400. Sitting in a sparse hotel room in the Mentawai capital of Tuapajat, he recalls seeing the signs of undernourishment and disease.
Well, we went just out of curiosity's sake into the town and realized that the situation wasn't good just by looking at the kids.
Jenkins told the head of the village he'd get his doctor's bag and hold a clinic. When he came back, 100 people were waiting. They came with tuberculosis, with worms, with malaria. Mentawais were dying every day from preventable diseases, diseases long ago vanquished in wealthier countries. Something has to be done about this, Jenkins thought, so he did. He quit a cozy job with a six-figure salary, and in January 2000, he founded Surf Aid. In a thatch-roofed wooden house in Katiet, a radio plays Mentawai music. Ristina Sakyadan's three children run through the house giggling. Ristina's long black hair is neatly tied back. She's wearing jeans and a black t-shirt, and she radiates competence. Ristina was among the first surfaid volunteers in Katiet.
Membantu masyarakat bisa sehat supaya kita tahu caranya.
We can help people be healthier. We can help them understand how to fight malaria. That's why I wanted to be involved.
The symptoms of malaria include fever, chills, nausea, and vomiting. Victims can spend weeks in bed, shaking and sweating. Children who get it multiple times wind up underweight, anemic, and vulnerable to other deadly diseases. But malaria can be prevented. The mosquitoes that spread it bite at night, so insecticide-treated mosquito nets are especially effective. Volunteers like Ristina distribute the nets and show families how to use them. They also teach their neighbors how to get rid of standing water where mosquitoes breed.
We showed them how to clean their yards, throw away cans, clean their houses. Now there's less malaria.
SurfAid statistics claim a 75% drop in malaria in the villages where they've launched programs. Jenkins says local volunteers like Ristina are the key because information is much more meaningful coming from a neighbor than from a SurfAid employee.
There's an element of trust involved. So if you're going to change behavior, you must have that, otherwise it doesn't work. And also, there they are in the house. We're talking about, right, you've got to have a special place to wash your hands. Okay, here we are in your house. This is the logical place. Let's go over here. So it's interactive learning.
Helping people stay healthy takes money, and at first that was a struggle. But as the malaria program started getting results, SurfAid started getting noticed. The surf industry saw an opportunity to do some good and boost its image at the same time. In 2004, clothing manufacturer Quiksilver sent one of its star surfers, Strider Wasilewski, on a Mentawai fundraising tour called Wave of Compassion.
I took up the offer and went for the ride, and it was pretty amazing.
Wasilewski and other surfers went deep into the Mentawai jungle. They helped out at a traveling dental clinic and visited the graves of children who'd died of malaria. Mentawai tribesmen threw them a feast, performed traditional dances for them, and lavished them with hospitality.
All they were doing was giving you everything they had, basically, anything you wanted to be comfortable and to feel at home and to give you, you know, life almost. And you just, you know, you wanted to do the same thing for them. You want to help more, you know, when you really get in there and you see it.
That's an impulse Dave Jenkins hopes a lot of surfers will feel in the years to come. He's encouraging the local resorts and boat companies to adopt what's called a philanthropic tourism model. That could mean organizing a day for surfers to hang up malaria nets or simply donating a portion of each guest's hotel or boat bill toward community development. After all, Jenkins says, surfers already feel a passionate attachment to their favorite spots. He believes this could only strengthen it.
There are people here who come on a boat here and they live for that 2 weeks of their life every year. They have pictures at their office. And also to have the opportunity to make the world a better place by buying mosquito nets for little kids you've seen on your holiday is an opportunity and is a model for it, which is good for resort business. So I think there's a real win-win potential here.
Back in Katiet, the midday sun scorches the beach. There are no cars here, nor are there any roads to drive them on. Main Street is a concrete footpath. It's lined with small, neat houses, some wooden with thatched roofs, others concrete topped with corrugated metal. Chickens and wild pigs roam the yards. As they walk into town, Dave Jenkins and SurfAid program manager Pramina Pubalan meet a friend.
Junaidi, apakabad.
How are you doing? Jenkins asked Junaidi, a four-year-old boy peeking out of a modest wooden house.
He looks a bit better.
He does, actually.
Yeah, he's kind of smiling.
Junaidi runs out of his house and jumps into Jenkins' arms with a grin. 3 months ago, Junaidi was listless and showed little curiosity. Now his eyes sparkle and he tries to grab everything within reach, including Jenkins' nose. What's made the difference is a change in diet. Before, Junaidi mostly ate taro root and bananas. Jenkins urged his parents to start fishing and gathering wild spinach in the forest to enrich the boy's diet. He's delighted with the results.
Doing well, aren't you, mate? It's good.
Jenkins has big plans. He'd like to see the Mentawai people solve more health problems on their own. He'd like to see them build a strong, sustainable economy. And he'd like Surf Aid to be here, not dictating the terms of change, but helping with advice and funding when needed. It's a long-term vision with no guarantee of results. But for now, Jenkins delights in the health and happiness of one small Mentawai boy. For Only a Game, I'm Trish Anderton in Khatiyet, Indonesia.
Track and field, lacrosse, and auto racing are but a few of the sports warranting the adjective fast-paced. As if not to be outdone, members of the Nebraska Auctioneers Association gathered in August of 2006 to test their skills against each other. Nebraska Public Radio's Avishai Artsy attended the event in Syracuse, Nebraska, and he filed this report.
My first item up today, item number 11A, will be the Pop's Greasy Spoon metal sign right there. Who'd help me out there? Give about $25 $25.
It's a Sunday evening in the banquet hall of the Odo County Fairgrounds in southeast Nebraska. 23 of the state's top auctioneers are battling it out to see who is the fastest, clearest, and most knowledgeable bid caller in the state. The youngest contestant is a fresh-faced 18-year-old in a crisp pinstripe suit who graduated from high school this spring.
I'm Trev Morvick. I'm from David City, Nebraska. I've been in the auction business since I was about 5 years old. My dad's an auctioneer, Russ Morvick, and also my brother, Matt Morvick. For the most part, we just do car sales during the week on Wednesdays. I work at the Lincoln Auto Auction Thursday at the Omaha Auto Auction.
Russ Morvick says his son was a born auctioneer.
I think he was about 4 years old. We'd stand him up on a folding chair, and he would work auctions. He'd take bids. He basically grew up in the business. I'll never forget, we had a real estate sale. I took him. He was about 2.5 years old, and the other auctioneer says, "Why are you bringing him? He's going to make noise." I says, "No, he won't." He sat so intent listening to the auctioneer.
Trev Morvick attended a week-long training program at an auction college in Mason City, Iowa. Another graduate of the program, Rusty Reynolds, is a 22-year-old from rural Minden, Nebraska.
At auction school, they teach you everything from tongue twisters, like the big brown bug bit a big brown bear, to counting drills and everything else. So,
what are some counting drills?
Counting drills, just simple counting drills. One, 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 two, two, two. Just kind of to develop your rhythm and things.
Reynolds says his favorite thing to sell is farm equipment. He says people are always fascinated when they discover his vocation.
The first thing that you hear is, so you're one of those people that count fast when you say yes, you know. So, yeah, a lot of people are surprised, and, of course, they always want to hear you auction. You know, so I find myself in elevators and everywhere else along the street auctioning all the time for people.
Yeah. Will you do something for me? Really?
Sure. All right. Heave it to get two and have it to get $5. Five it a bit, five it to get five, $7.50, down $10. So it's just a bunch of filler words with numbers in the middle.
All right. Here we go. What are you going to do here? Down, right there, down. Give me $10. I'm going to get $10. $15 down, $20.
The competition hall is filled to capacity. The contestants stand nervously in their stiffly starched dress shirts and cowboy hats, some clean-shaven, some with neatly trimmed goatees. About 300 audience members are dressed casually and sit on rows of folding chairs. Next to their growing piles of newly purchased tools and belt buckles, there's even a toy tractor. Looking around the room, it's easy to spot the one contestant who stands out from the others.
I'm Aura Adler, and I'm with Adler Auction Service out of Hastings, Nebraska. I guess the reason I like to compete in this contest, I'm usually the only woman, but I want the public to know that there are women out in the auction business, and so I come to have fun. I guess that's one of the main ideas of the whole thing, is to have fun. I guess I just loved auctions, and I used to trail along with my dad when I was little, and I found that chant of the auctioneer very exciting. So my husband, when our children were a little bit older, he said, if you want to go to school, go do it, and that's what I did.
Adler's husband, Jerry, is a retired physician. He works as Aura's ring man, assisting her by jumping up and yelping when he sees someone indicate a bid. He says taking bids is a skill in itself.
Occasionally you will get into somebody who is swatting a fly and then you take a bid, which is a mistake, and you'll back off. But you, by and large, after you're trained well enough, you can pick up the real ones from the mistaken ones.
Two and a half.
Wearing a blue NASCAR t-shirt, former contestant Dick Stitch sits silently in the audience, taking notes and rating each auctioneer. He's been in the business for over two decades.
One of the things that I was watching for is the auctioneer that works with an open hand, not pointing at the bidder, because a lot of times bidders don't like to be recognized. They don't want other people to know they're bidding. So it's best to just use the open hand and bring them in. And one other thing I watch for is the auctioneer that when he gets toward the end, he says, "You all in, you all done." Actually, he's warning them that he is done. And there's people that will wait till they hear that before they bid. So you're best not to warn them.
Another bid-calling veteran here today is Bill Rutt. Rutt was the bid-calling champion in 1992, though he's been working auctions for far longer.
I've been in the business since 1964 and graduated out of high school, went to auction school and started out. Sold purebred hog sales, antique sales, farm sales, and I run a sale barn at Crete, Nebraska. So been good business, been a good fun business. Meet a lot of good people in the auction business.
Rutt sports his championship belt buckle, along with a gray cowboy hat and black leather boots. He says some might think auctioneering is just being able to talk fast, but he says it's not as easy as it looks.
Selling a sale probably wears you out more than working, digging ditches all day, because you're mentally fatigued at the end of the day, because you're really using your mind, keeping straight what the bid is and what your next item are you're going to sell. And so, yeah, it works on you.
And ladies and gentlemen, it is a privilege for me to be able to present to you the 2006 Nebraska Bid Calling Champion, and it goes to a gentleman that's becoming a friend of mine, and that's Mr. Rusty Reynolds.
Reynolds will get an all-expenses-paid trip to the National Convention in San Diego, where the International Auctioneers Contest will be held next July. Trev Morvick of David City, Nebraska, placed second. For Only a Game, I'm Avishai Artsy in Syracuse, Nebraska.
You're listening to Only a Game. It is customary at this time of year to discuss bests and worsts. Best is easy. 2006 was World Cup year. That meant that I got to watch England play in the company of a large number of citizens and ex-citizens of England who had gathered in a pub in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Some of them wore their team's colors proudly. Others wore them ironically, sure that England would let them down, if not sooner, then certainly later. And they were right. But together, the two groups taught me songs and chants, which I could repeat here if I'd already lined up a job somewhere else. I also watched the U.S. team play, and that would have been a disappointing experience were I not more a fan of the game than of a particular team, because I also watched Brazil, Italy, Mexico, Spain, and all the other teams competing in Germany. I'm pretty sure I saw at least part of every game. Hard work, sure, but somebody had to do it. Unhappily, worst is also easy. In September, I attended an informal reunion with some guys I'd known in college. Somebody suggested tennis. Doubles, he said, just a friendly match. Somewhere between my ears, a faulty neuron fired and led me to imagine that since I'd be playing with my college friends, I'd play as well as I had when I was in college. The details of the resultant misadventure are as predictable as they are grim. Suffice it to say that the U.S. soccer team's effort at the World Cup was brilliant in comparison. A recording of the match would feature me shouting, "You take it!" I shouted that a lot, and when I didn't have breath enough to shout, "You take it," I shouted, "Yours." The message here, carried by knees that ached for weeks, is that if we are not Tom Glavine or Christine Lilly or Vinnie Testaverde, we get old. So at the end of one year, anticipating the beginning of another, I find myself more respectful than ever of those athletes who not only carry on, but carry on as if it didn't hurt now any more than it did when they were young and it was easy and time let them play without the need afterward of ice and aspirin. And I find myself marveling, too, at the adjustments the rest of us make as we find ourselves deciding that though the games are no less compelling than they've ever been, it's fine now and certainly less humiliating to mostly just watch.
But in case I stand one little chance, here comes the jackpot question in advance. What are you doing, New
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, why competitive chili cooking is the spice of life, for some wacky Nebraskans anyway. But first, have you ever been tempted to step out of an airplane and hurtle toward the earth at speeds upward of 130 miles an hour? Neither have I, but early in 2006, Only a Game's Karen Given was, so she visited the country's oldest indoor skydiving center in Las Vegas, and she filed this report.
Flyaway Indoor Skydiving occupies a former bank in a nondescript shopping center less than 2 blocks from the glitz and glamour of the Las Vegas Strip. From the outside, the place is rather unimposing. That is, until you notice the octagonal structure tacked onto the north side. It's that part of the building, the wind tunnel, that has me standing on the curb for a few minutes, trying to find the nerve to go in. Once inside, the center has the laid-back vibe of a Southern California surf shop. On this quiet Wednesday morning, instructors lounge around the front desk, swapping stories and hanging out, led by manager Dave McMahon.
What's happening?
Not much. It looks kind of scary from out there.
Oh, it's too much fun. It should be illegal. All right. You're flying, right?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Name, age, height, and weight.
Okay.
Dave gives me a quick form to fill out before I'm to be whisked upstairs for my 20-minute training session with an instructor named Josh. Since arriving in Las Vegas a few days ago, I've only mentioned my appointment at Flyaway to 2 people. The first told me I'd be safer jumping out of a real airplane. The second insisted there are so many injuries at Flyaway, local ambulance drivers have been instructed to turn off their sirens when entering the neighborhood. It's that second rumor that Dave finds most intriguing.
The ambulance thing, it's hilarious, because we actually, Kevin, one of our instructors, he actually was like trying to become a paramedic at one point, so he was going on all these runs. Because it was Kevin's buddies, they started coming over here hanging out. We had to be like, listen, we like you guys, but we really can't have an ambulance just sitting outside the front door. You got to move that. Yeah,
hide that somewhere.
Don't have an ambulance ready to go. And we don't have injuries very often at all. It's more the injuries happen with us when we're trying to do stupid stuff like backflips to the wall.
Dave is pretty laid back about the whole indoor skydiving thing. A few months ago, he took his 2-year-old daughter into the tunnel for her birthday. His wife didn't object because, well, the white bridal flying suit displayed in the upstairs hallway belongs to her.
Me and my wife got married in the tunnel on October 1st. It's me and my wife met in the tunnel. It's where we, you know, the first time I ever set eyes on her was in the tunnel. And so it just kind of made sense that we kind of seal the deal there too, I guess, right? Did the ceremony in the tunnel and shuttled everybody out real quick, topped it out, and flew up to the top to kiss.
So you weren't trying to say your vows over the roar of the engine?
No, that would be ridiculous.
This is Las Vegas, but most people don't come to Flyaway to get married. Skydivers come to places like this to practice. And people like me, looking for a thrill but not ready for the real thing, come here to try out body flight. Indoor skydiving may be less deadly, less expensive, and less intimidating than jumping out of an airplane, but Dave says that doesn't mean the sport is less difficult.
This is harder. The tunnel is definitely harder. You only have a 12-foot sky. Up there, you can mess up all you want. You're still going to be in the sky. Here, you have to refine your body position. You really have to focus on what you're doing more. Wind tunnel flying is a little different than skydiving because of that reason and because we're pushing air past you. You're not falling through clean air. So you got to work for it a little bit more, which makes you a better body flyer.
Newer indoor skydiving centers, like the one opening in New Hampshire this summer, try to solve that problem by sucking the air from above the flyer rather than blowing it from below, an innovation they say makes the sport less dangerous and easier to master. Built in the early 80s, Flyaway is old school, which hasn't stopped Flyaway employees like Dave from using almost unlimited flight time to master front and back flips, head-down carves, and tricks of a more exotic nature.
Like I do the shrimp kebab, which is one I got to name because it's my trick, and nobody, I can barely do it, I can't even do it, but it's like a shrimp on a kebab. It's 2 shrimp.
Come on in, guys, watch your step.
An instructor named Corey leads a group of 3 snowboarding instructors from Vail, Colorado, into the tunnel for their 3-minute flights. The flyers are wearing baggy flight suits designed to capture the air and fill up like balloons. But Corey makes a big production out of wrapping a wide weightlifting belt around his t-shirt and pants.
No, it does not hold me down on the ground, and I don't have a bad back today. What it does do is it keeps my clothes on, and I'm serious about that. It really does keep my clothes on. Good, right, Dave?
Thank you for wearing that.
Dave saw me without my shirt on one time. He went home crying to his mom.
It's an easy joke, and one that all the instructors here seem to use to lighten the mood. Corey shuts the tunnel door and pantomimes proper body position. Once the fan gets going, it will be even more important to communicate without words, as the fan makes talking or even shouting impossible. All three of Corey's charges manage to fly, with varying success, staying just a few feet above the net and safety pads. Between each one-minute flight, Corey hops into the airstream to illustrate technique. During the third and final flight, Corey feels confident enough about one flyer that he lifts him above his head and tosses him higher like pizza dough.
That takes, you know, a little technique. Also, depending on the flyer, some people... Worst time is if you throw them up there and then they freak out and then they try to, like, fall on you.
Corey's been an instructor for about a year, but before that, he was one of Flyaway's least successful customers.
I was horrible, actually. I was god-awful. But, yeah, I wanted to come back and, you know, like, actually do it. I don't want anybody to touch me. I want to do it on my own. And then after I started to get it, it was, like, addicting. Every time I fly, still today, I'd learn new stuff in the tunnel every time.
Corey's become so enamored of flying that he's training to become a certified skydiver. At each level, he must perform certain skills in the air to the satisfaction of the instructor he's paid to accompany him. That's when having a nearby wind tunnel comes in handy.
In the sky, the most you get, I have gotten so far, it might have been 55, but that's a long time in the sky. Most tandem jumps are, you know, anywhere from 45 to 50 seconds. Whereas in here, you know, you spend 3 minutes in there, you're flying for a solid 3 minutes. It's a lot of fun.
Come on in and have a seat.
Oh, boy.
When it's my turn to fly, Josh leads me into a classroom to watch a 5-minute video, which starts predictably with experienced skydivers performing all sorts of amazing tricks at indoor and outdoor skydiving centers around the world.
Welcome to Flyaway. Right after this tape and a short briefing, you'll be able to taste the thrill of skydiving without ever leaving the ground at America's first indoor skydiving wind tunnel.
The video cheerfully explains proper body position, hand signals, and safety procedures. And then things get serious.
Body flying is lots of fun, but you have to be aware of the risks involved. When your instructor comes back in the classroom, he's going to give you a waiver. This legal document states that you're aware that just like skydiving and other related sports, you could be seriously injured or even killed. It's our policy to give you a full refund if you decide not to fly at this point.
Waiver signed, Josh hands me a huge flying suit to put on over my clothes, goggles to keep my contacts from blowing away, and, at my request, a bright pink helmet.
You're starting to look even more and more ridiculous. Gotta be honest.
I'm more than a little nervous as Josh leads me into the wind tunnel for my flight. The room is padded all around, and the 12-foot flying column is surrounded by thick foam safety pads. Josh has me practice flinging myself onto them. It's not only expected, but guaranteed that I will fall out of the air column a few times during my flight. Then I take position face down on the bouncy net that's suspended above the 12-foot fan. The fan starts slowly at first, buffeting me inches off the net and then back down. From the control room, another instructor slowly increases the power, so I'm lifted up off the net by inches at first, then feet, until finally I'm looking eye to eye with Josh, who's standing upright on the net, pushing and pulling at my arms and legs to get me into correct flying position. It was only 30 seconds of flight, but I'm glad for a rest as Dave jumps into the air, twisting and turning with ease. When it's my turn again, Josh signals me to jump into the airstream as if I'm diving into a pool of water. Somehow, it works, and I find my balance in the column of air. This time, I'm more confident and stable enough that Dave jumps in with me, flipping and spinning while I try to stay out of his way. When my 3 minutes are up, I tuck and roll for a soft landing on the safety pads, uninjured, exhausted, and still giggling.
That was excellent!
Whoa!
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Las Vegas.
Wow!
It's a rush, huh?
That's a lot of wind.
Chili cooks from across the nation and beyond descended on Omaha, Nebraska in October of 2006 to battle it out for the right to be called world's champion. For 40 years, the International Chili Society has brought together chili connoisseurs to compete for prestige, bragging rights, and thousands of dollars in prize money. As Nebraska Public Radio's Martin Wells reports from Omaha, some like it hot.
Bonnie Tomasek has been cooking competition chili for 20 years. She says she started because she didn't like her husband's cooking and thought she could do better.
All right, this is jungle green chili. I am a Colorado cook. Colorado is the home of green chili. It's one of our major crops. It's one of our native dishes, also New Mexico. You'll get this dish served to you in New Mexico and Colorado. So this is a very authentic one. It's very hot. This is the People's Choice green chili that I'm serving now. What I turn into the judges is not going to be as hot because they can't handle it.
Not all chili is hot, though many cooks like to play up that factor, like Dave Schulman of Avon, Connecticut. Schulman named his chili No Antidote. His booth features a banner with a red-eyed skeleton and a chef's hat stirring a steaming black cauldron. But Schulman says, despite that, people shouldn't be scared off.
I think there's a general perception that chili is like blazing hot. And good chili is not blazing hot. It's spicy, but it's not, you know, it's not supposed to hurt you. But a lot of people don't know that. So it's fun to, you know, play to the prejudices, so to speak.
So what makes a world champion chili? Fred Whelan of Pahrump, Nevada knows. He's been the chief judge of the contest for the past 15 years.
Four things that I look for. A good heat in the back of the throat. I like a good cumin level. That's the dominant spice in chili. I like a nice garlic aftertaste without actually being able to taste the garlic. It's just the effect that it has. And I like the right amount of salt. That brings everything up. If a bowl has those in correct balance, they're probably going to win.
It's Whelan's responsibility to instruct the other judges on the six guidelines for award-winning chili.
Good flavoring, chili pepper taste, not too hot or mild. The texture of the meat, not too tough or mushy. Consistency, not too thick or thin. The blend of the spices and how well they have permeated the meat. Aroma, usually a personal preference, and color. And that's all I tell them. If they can't figure it out without, they're in serious trouble.
As Whelan is constantly reminding everyone, the event is really about having fun.
After I have my cooks meeting, I tell all the cooks, if you don't have a good time today, it's your own damn fault.
One group that has taken that advice to heart is the Coconut Girls. Their Hawaiian-themed booth and coconut-top T-shirts indicate they're from the islands of Aberdeen, South Dakota. Mary Musil is the group's leader.
We were nurses that worked in the intensive care unit together and working a night shift and decided, hey, what can we do different than we did the last time for our booth that would, like, bring people in? And this is it. Tops with coconuts on it and grass skirts and the whole Hawaiian theme, and it's kind of gone from there, and we've had a great time with it since.
This is the Coconut Girls' first trip to the World's Championship, and like most cooks, Musil is not about to give away her secrets.
I can't tell you the rest or I'd have to kill you. And then we'd resuscitate you.
Yeah.
And bring you back for more.
Showmanship seems to be as important to these chili cooks as the product itself. Debbie Turner of Waxahachie, Texas, says it's a tradition born in the early days of chili cook-offs back in the 1960s.
It wasn't just cooking your chili. It was barking the public in, because in the early days, it was the judges walked around to the booths and tasted the chili, and the people tried to convince the judges verbally, you know, with all this stuff, that I'm the best. So we kind of harken back to the old days.
Debbie is the cook, while her husband, Wayne, is the barker. He's quick to play up his wife's chili and play down the competition.
They're not from Texas. You got to understand. I mean, we're proud of our state and proud of our product. It's our state dish. And she is even the advisor to Governor Perry, chili advisor to Governor Perry for the state.
The main event of the weekend is the grand prize for traditional red, awarded on Sunday night. This year, the event is tinged with sadness due to the impending retirement of Chief Judge Fred Wieland and his wife, Leah. International Chili Society CEO Carol Hancock chokes up while paying tribute to the Wielands.
And you know what? There isn't enough things for us to say. But what we're going to say is, you know what, Fred and Leah? If you didn't have a good time for the past 10, 15 years, it's your own damn fault.
And then the moment everyone is waiting for.
And the envelope, please. The 40th anniversary of the International Chili Society's World Championship Chili Cook-Off. Your 2006 World Champion, well-deserved, is J.R. Knutson.
90-year-old J.R. Knutson, dressed in a red apron and straw hat, looks stunned as the announcement is made. He's quickly mobbed by his fellow cooks and led up on stage.
Needless to say, this is a surprise for me. You know, I had no idea I was even going to come close. I would have bet that I didn't even make the final table.
For his award-winning traditional red chili, Knutson received a check from the International Chili Society for $25,000, along with an additional $5,000 from the cook-off's main sponsor, not to mention bragging rights for the next year. For Only a Game, I'm Martin Wells in Omaha, Nebraska. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to peruse our panoply of podcasts, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from the conductor. He really does exist. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.